All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the College Investor Live. I am excited to be here with Andrew Paulson from Student Loan Advice. And I think this is going to be an exciting episode because we are going to talk about a very hot topic, which is student loan debt and what is happening with student loans right now in the United States. And I think we're going to cover the whole gamut of stuff. Like we can talk Biden's loan forgiveness, public service loan forgiveness. I don't think a lot of people know that there's just a lot of other like regulatory changes happening behind the scenes this year. So I think we can touch on some of that. And then I really hope that we get some viewer and reader questions because we're here. I think Andrew knows his stuff. He's a certified student loan planner. I know a ton about student loan debt. And so between the two of us, I hope that we can answer your student loan questions. So Andrew, you want to just do a quick intro? Tell me a little about yourself. And we'll see as we get some viewers going on here. What's going on?
I'm kind of a, I guess, a certified student loan nerd. I am working with people on the daily, kind of like a financial coach, just basically on student loan advice. And so effectively, if somebody has to take out a mortgage to go through school, whether that's for your MBA, for medical school, for veterinarian school, law school, anything, all the above, I help you get out of debt and understand, how to do that in the in a way that's going to save you the most money, whether that's through a forgiveness program, through refinancing. And I've been doing this for a couple of years now. I'm partnered up with another organization called the White Coat Investor. And yeah, I love getting to help people out and really being able to see kind of that light go off when somebody realizes that there's a way to get out of their debt. So.
Absolutely. So you can find Andrew here, but we'll jump right into it. So, what do you think is going on with Biden's student loan forgiveness plan, I guess we can say, or proposal? I mean, it kind of was a plan, kind of a proposal, but it's on hold. It's we're waiting on the Supreme Court. So do you want to give everyone a rundown? Because I also think that confused a lot of people. I mean, so many people.
It's so what happened was, well, when Biden was, in his in the process of trying to become elected, he talked about when he was running that one of his campaign promises was student loan forgiveness. And so, a couple of years in, people are like, hey, when's this forgiveness going to come up? And so, and then of course COVID hit and payments paused, and which I know we'll talk about all that stuff, but August last year, the president issued an executive action. And as part of that, it was the student loan forgiveness. So this pertains to borrowers that are making under $250,000 if you're married, or $125,000 if you're single. So effectively, if you make below that amount, you could be eligible for up to $20,000 in student loan forgiveness. If you took out Pell Grants, if you didn't take out Pell, then you'd be eligible for $10,000. So on a household basis, if you're married, you could get $40,000 wiped away, clean slate from your federal student loans. So this was able to happen because there's a big legal act. It's called the HEROES Act. I won't get into kind of all the nuts and bolts, but in times of national emergency and pandemic, the president has the ability to issue executive action over student loans. And instead of going through the normal lawmaking process, going through Congress, they could issue executive actions. And that's what they've done with the student loan pause, but they also were going to pass this student loan forgiveness. Well, what happened is the student loan forgiveness is a lot easier to quantify than all these pauses and no payments and whatnot. And they had come up with a number of about the cost was going to be about $400 billion to do this. And so after the executive order is issued, student loans were going to start getting forgiven at the end of last year, like in November, or you just fill out an easy application on studentaid.gov, and you could start to receive forgiveness. Well, as we are well aware, that has not happened thus far. There was a couple of lawsuits that came out early on that didn't really do much, but more recently, I think it was about December, January time, there was a bigger one that came from a conservative court that has had the most merit thus far that has effectively blocked this student loan forgiveness. And If any of you have been following the Supreme Court, we do have a conservative majority Supreme Court. So I know that they're going to hear this student loan forgiveness case in February, but in all likelihood, they're probably not going to come up with a decision in my mind until summer before they take their summer recess. And I think at the end of the day, this $10,000 to $20,000 is probably not going to go through, just given where the Supreme Court lies with it being a Republican majority. And I think they're really going to strike it down. So don't want to kind of burst the bubble for a lot of you, but this is just my expectation, is that it's not going to end up going through at the end of the day.
And I think that's a fair one. I think, there's a lot of questions about whether he's allowed to do it by executive order or not. I think there's also a lot of other scenarios, right? So the Republicans now control the House of Representatives. There's talk that Congress might actually sue, or the House of Representatives might sue to block it as well. So some of these questions about standing and who's allowed to block it, well, that might get resolved anyways if the House of Representatives does, because Congress definitely could block it and say the president does not have this power. That's a congressional power only. And you get into some bigger questions here. But at the same time, we're here to help borrowers. And I think a lot of people, you know, this 10 to 20,000 or up to, you know, what you said, 40,000 for a couple married, it could be a big deal, but there are some actually really good programs right now that are helping people. And I think one of the biggest is public service loan forgiveness. And, a lot of people don't realize how vast and powerful public service loan forgiveness is, because you work in public service for 10 years / 120 payments, and you get your federal student loans forgiven tax-free. And that is a huge benefit. And what I don't think a lot of people realize is what is included in public service jobs, right? So we always hear teachers a lot, or we hear doctors or things, but it's like, you could be the accountant at the school district.
Right.
You could be the bus driver. You could be like anybody in these jobs, whether that's federal, state, local government, nonprofits, emergency services, education. Like, it's a vast amount of people that potentially qualify for these things. And I feel like we always get hung up on teachers. Not to say that we shouldn't, teachers need help, but like, there's a lot of other people that could benefit. Aides, you know, these young kids fresh out of college that are like assistant teachers, like they get their loans forgiven. Nurses, all types of hospital staff, as long as you work for the hospital and not an independent organization. So there's a lot of potential there. But I also don't think that people realize like what some of the things that have been going on now. So, you know, there was a waiver last year. There's been a lot of updates to PSLF. Do you want to kind of give us a rundown on what people can expect with PSLF right now and what actions they need to take? Because I don't think people even know, like they're like October 31st. Now it's this year.
Yeah.
Now it's like, what's going on?
No, exactly. And I will say that, you know, if you do have federal loans and you do have, and if you are working in public service, you should definitely look into it. Definitely dig in, get your arms around this forgiveness program, because there's been over 350,000 borrowers that have had their loans forgiven through public service loan forgiveness. You know, a year and a half ago, it was like 15,000, you know, so we've seen this big spike. And so, you know, in terms of what's happened lately, as you'd already alluded to, there's this public service loan forgiveness waiver that basically allowed people that never qualified or people that had the wrong type of loans that were these family federal education loans, you know, to qualify. And so effectively you had to have direct federal loans. And a lot of people who, most of you who borrowed before 2010 didn't have these loans. You have these other types of federal student loans, but they were getting excluded from the overall forgiveness. And in order to get your loans forgiven, you had to get them into the right status. So you had to check this box effectively and consolidate your loans. But when you consolidate your loans, what it does is it actually erases all your prior payment history. So somebody, you know, picture a teacher that had worked for 10 years and now they're trying to qualify, and their loan servicer is like, hey, guess what? Your loans don't qualify. You got to consolidate them. And the 10 years starts from today. And I think that really started to discourage a lot of people from doing the forgiveness program. They're like, you know what? I'm just not even going to put in the hassle, because this stuff takes time, you know, and there's the federal process that you have to go through with paperwork and whatnot that can be a little bit time consuming. So essentially this PSLF waiver allowed anybody to kind of qualify, you know, based on any type of loans, as long as they had qualifying employment. And you could even you could have been on any repayment program, where typically you have to be on these income driven or income based repayment programs in order for you to qualify. And those are about 10% of what your take home pay is, basically. So they were allowing people that were on the wrong repayment plan, that had the wrong type of loans. And even if you weren't working at a nonprofit or a 501c3, as long as you've done that for a decade in the past, since you borrowed, you could still qualify. And so that definitely was allowing a lot of people to get their loans forgiven. And you know, I met with a ton of people last year that were like, I never thought I qualified. And, you know, then they've been sending me nice notes that they were. So there's that. And that kind of went through October 31st. But there's also another waiver that's called the income-driven repayment waiver, which is kind of an extension of the public service loan forgiveness waiver, where they're counting periods of time, you know, but like what I had alluded to earlier with wrong repayment plan, wrong type of loans, but also if you didn't make payments for a while, let's say you had a, you know, family situation came up and you couldn't make payments temporarily, or, you know, for whatever reason, you couldn't make payments and you had to go into forbearance. Well, if you had 12 months of a consecutive forbearance, or, you know, longer than 36 months of forbearance, those are counting to the different forgiveness programs as if it were credit, right? So there's all these different things that, you know, can really advance your ability to loan forgiveness that we've never seen before. So definitely, you know, check that out. And you know, and we're not just talking about that, you know, this pertains to the public service loan forgiveness program, but it also pertains to the 20 to 25 year income driven repayment forgiveness for those of you that aren't in public service, right? But still are interested in forgiveness programs. And I'd say like one other thing I would add on public service loan forgiveness is typically you have to be working full time for a minimum of 30 hours per week at multiple employers to qualify for public service loan forgiveness. So this employment qualification can get kind of muddy and kind of tricky, but part of the executive order that President Biden issued last year, you know, with the student loan forgiveness, they also talked about how they're trying to make some little adjustments to the public service loan forgiveness program, wherein it's a flat 30 hours per week. So that would kind of help clear up some people when they're having questions on what qualifies and what doesn't.
No, I mean, there's so many great changes there. I think you covered a lot of it. I also think the one that people don't realize is that all these months of the student loan pause count towards public service. So, you know, we're at almost what? We're at 34 months, I think, right now.
Right.
Student loan pause. You know, I'm guessing that we're going to at least get to 40 months probably on the early side if they don't extend it. But if you're going for public service loan forgiveness, that is one third of all your qualifying years that you just didn't even have to make a single payment on your loan. And so now you're taking people that had to be on a 10-year loan forgiveness program and you're effectively making it a 6.5-year, you know, loan forgiveness program, which is phenomenal for a lot of people. And same thing with the IDR, you know, forgiveness as well, because, you know, frankly, I do think that's a big one that a lot of people don't talk about, because, you know, if you had these old federal family loans from way back in 2000, you should be getting your loan forgiveness anytime now.
Right.
But they weren't, because they didn't keep accurate records for, mm-hmm. you know, a decade. And so those types of loans are going to see a lot of benefit from just the next couple years qualifying under these programs. And so I think that's a big one. I also think, like, you do a lot of doctor work, and I'm in California. And so, like, you know, they definitely threw the bone out to the California ER docs and different things here, because you could be a doctor and not necessarily work for the hospital now,
right,
as long as your organization works for the hospital. So it's wonky, but I've gotten about a dozen doctors that reached out and they're like, does this mean I qualify now? And it's like, yeah.
Yeah, that's a, and it's unique to California and Texas physicians, right? So everybody else out there, if you're a provider, you don't, right? But effectively, there's a state law in California and Texas that disallows you to be employed directly by a specific hospital. So what happens is, even though you're working at a county hospital or a region hospital, right? You are effectively employed by a contractor that then works with the hospital. But effectively, they're and they haven't released exactly who qualifies yet, but I've been getting a lot of questions on that too recently.
It's just such a silly setup. I mean, you talk about the bureaucracy perpetuating the bureaucracy, but I'm glad to see that we're solving that loophole, because those are people that can definitely qualify for loan forgiveness now, potentially, as long as you meet those other requirements. I think the other thing that people need to realize is, what do you need to submit for public service loan forgiveness? So even though you haven't been making payments, do you still need to certify your employment for the last 3-4 years?
Yeah, and it's a great question, Robert. So there's a certification form. They call it an employment certification form or PSLF certification form. All you have to do is go to studentaid.gov/PSLF, and it pulls up all that detail. They even built a new little tool that you can fill out. There's a paper form, or you can do it through this help tool that's on the website, right? But all it is effectively you put in there your information, and then you have your manager sign it or human resources sign it, and then you upload it on your employer's website. And I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about this. If, you know, you don't have to do it. It looks like you're getting it up right now.
I just got it up. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. So yeah, you know, this is it. It's this first page where when you're in what I call the accumulation phase, years 1 through 9, you just on section 2, you check the first box. I want to find out how many qualifying payments I've made, you know, a little bit of detail on there. And then if you go to the second page, all it is you put your employer name on there, the employment identification number. It's on your W-2, you know, or you can phone your HR people. And then you just check the boxes. And then in section 4, you just have your employer sign it. And then the last step in section number 7, I believe, is then you just either mail it, you fax it, or if Mohila, the PSLF loan servicer right now, if they're already your servicer, it's just a simple file upload. That's it. And
I'm a big fan. Upload the files. Don't rely on the mail.
Upload it.
Mail it, certified mail.
Upload it because it keeps a record, right? It keeps a record of when you did it. And if you're ever like scrambling, gosh, where was that fax that I sent, right? Or where was that mail that I sent? How often do we make a photocopy of the scan or the thing that we mailed, right? We don't do that enough, but this keeps an electronic record. And I want to tell you, I just got off the phone with a physician, and they had not made any payments over the last, you know, almost 3 years because of COVID. And they're like, hey, I haven't made any payments. Does this qualify? And I was able to tell him that, yes, all you have to do is get one of these filled out by your employer, and these last 3 years qualify. And he was mind blown because he thought that he had to do this each year. And I encourage people to do it each year, that, you know, because it's easiest to, you know, if you go through school, after you graduate school, to do it once a year at your different jobs, because presumably you're probably going to change jobs every now and then, right? And, you know, when you're reaching out to somebody that you worked for 8 years ago, it's probably going to be harder to get them to sign a piece of paper than when you were, you know, when you can just show up at their desk and get them signed, right? But this particular physician, they're going to save $250,000 on their student loans, because they now figured out that they can do PSLF. They just have to do all their forms retroactively. So pretty insane and mind-boggling, you know, the amount of money that people can save through this forgiveness program.
No, and that's amazing. And I think you nailed it. I think, remember, if you're doing this, do it every year at the minimum. You can wait. You can wait until all 120 payments are in and then send the form in. But I don't recommend that, like you said.
Don't do that.
Like, I've seen people have to do this, and they're like going back to their employer like from 7 years ago. And they're like, please sign my paper. And like, no one remembers who they are anymore. And like, the HR is like, I got to look in like the records. And it just becomes a mess. So do this every year. Also do it if you change jobs. So if you do change jobs every 6 months, like, make sure you get them to sign it before you leave your job and then go to your other job and get that done. And then please, please, please fill this out completely. So the number one reason why these forms are getting rejected still is like 36% of them that were rejected did not have fully filled out information. And I think the number one thing I always see is that federal employer identification number, like, people just don't know where to look for it. And it's on your W-2. And or if you haven't gotten a W-2 yet, because maybe it's your first, you know, 6 months working there, you need to call your HR and ask them, and they can get that information for you. But like, make sure you fill it out completely. Like, you know, there's nothing worse than like getting rejected and all you had to do was like fill out a form, but it is demoralizing to have to deal with that, right?
Yeah. And I mean, they are nitpicky. They, even the slightest things, like I had a teacher in Southern California that they filled this out in purple ink and they rejected it because of that. It literally, you have to fill it out in dark
blue ink. Or black ink or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Like blue, like dark blue or black ink. So, I mean, it's these little teeny, you know, knick-knacky things that you have to do. And then like another point that you talked about is the ability to do this regularly, because sometimes, you know, the prior job that you had, they go under, or sometimes they get bought out. I see this all the time with dentists and nurses and PAs, that where you were in a specific hospital, then it gets bought by some for-profit conglomerate. And now it's harder for you to get that signed off on. And it can be done. It's just a lot more difficult. There's sometimes your employer won't sign it. And they won't validate it. And on that first page, there is a box that you can actually check that if they won't sign it. It's right under the kind of the section two, the last kind of box there on that first page, where it says, check this box if you can't get your employer to sign it. So just because I know sometimes people are like, they won't do it for me, or I mean, it's a black hole. I've been reaching out. And so you do have that option, but just know it's going to be a little bit more of an uphill battle. So that's like, you know, doing this regularly is going to help. And I think the upload portal has made things a whole lot more simple to do it. But just because you're doing this and you're submitting this, don't expect them to get this right every single time. Okay. Just keep good records. And that's why doing this regularly, it takes you 5 minutes. If you do it once a year, then you'll be in good shape.
Absolutely. And I think even if you use the PSLO help tool on studentaid.gov, what it does is it fills out the first part for you with your name and info, and it fills out the second part for you, but you still need to print that form and have your employer sign section four here with their name and title, and then you upload that. So the PSLF help tool online is great, but just because you do it, it's not counting until you get your, you know, HR, your boss to sign off that you actually do work there, and then they'll qualify those payments for you. But like you said, there's still a lot of data issues. There's still a lot of accuracy issues. And the best thing that you can do is keep your records. So if you do, you know, have these forms, make a file, save all your copies for every year, you know, have them all ready to go. I recommend uploading them. I used to recommend sending them certified mail. So if you did send these certified mail like 4 or 5 years ago before, like you could upload them, you know, make sure you keep a copy of that certification. You can say like, hey, you know, FedLoan had this, or, you know, now it's Mohela. I don't know. I say Mohela. you know, they have it. You have that copy of it. But yes, it is a paperwork battle sometimes. But like, honestly, you could be getting tens of thousands of dollars forgiven. And to me, that's the most worthwhile, like, you know, pay by the hour. So even if I have to spend 2 or 3 hours a year dealing with this, you know, if you're giving me like 40, 50, 60,000 bucks, like that's totally worth the time and effort. And I know it's a hassle, but I always say too, that student loans are like the intersection of everything we hate as Americans. it's paperwork, it's debt, it's the government, it's like all taxes, like literally it's like the intersection of all of these things. And so I know it really can be like this annoying, frustrating endeavor, but it's so worth it.
Yeah. And it's such a different type of debt, right? Like what other debt can just go away, right? After you do, you know, check a couple of boxes, your mortgage isn't going away, right? That auto loan's not, the credit cards aren't going away, right? So you have to kind of bucket this, you know, with your overall finances in a little bit of a different area, because if you check these different boxes, you know, you know, 10 years as a public servant or 20 years on just one of the income driven repayment plans, this can totally go away. And you kind of have to think about it that you want to pay the least amount as possible. You want to put the least amount towards this, because whether it's $50,000 that you get forgiven in a decade or it's a penny, you still get that forgiven, you know, federally tax free, you know, whereas all the other kinds of debt. You're kind of trying to, you know, figure out this approach of how do I pay this down quicker potentially so that I pay less in interest.
And you nailed it. Like I always preach that is, you know, student loan debt should be treated much differently than credit card debt, auto loans, mortgages. You know, those are like, let's go the Dave Ramsey approach, like debt snowball, like let's lay it all out there and get it. But like, I don't want anyone paying their student loan debt, especially right now. Like if you are paying your student loans today that are paused, you are doing something financially wrong and you are putting yourself at a disadvantage because savings accounts that are perfectly safe earn 4% right now. And so take that $250 that you're paying towards your student loans or whatever that math happens to be and just throw it into a savings account every month. And you'll start earning money on your money. And then look, student loans on pause, something happens, no forgiveness happens. That's cool. Just throw it to your student loans if you want to. Exactly. Or you're in a better financial situation to make a decision at that point in time. But like, there's no guarantee that student loans are going to unpause. So, you know, let's just jump into that. What is the rule today? Because there's no date anymore of when student loans are going to unpause. What's the rule? And then what do you think is going to happen? What do you think is going to happen? And I'll share my thoughts on it too.
Yeah. So, I mean, as it currently stands, and this has been changing a bunch for anybody that's following this, right? Payments are set to resume 60 days after June 30th. So effectively or it could be prior to that if this student loan pause if the forgiveness goes through, right? So if they do grant this forgiveness, let's say they did it on February 1st, you could be paying 60 days thereafter on April 1st. Okay. But I think in all likelihood, I don't think the decision is going to be until summer. And so, I mean, as it's currently constituted, September 1st, but if this forgiveness doesn't go through, and that's my opinion that it doesn't, I could see them pushing payments until, you know, some as late as they could get them into 2024, because 2024 is an election year. So could you potentially not have to make any payments until 25? There is a chance that it could go that long before you'd have to make any payment, and the interest would be paused during that time.
Yep. No. And that's it. And so I'm kind of with you on the same thing. It's 60 days. You know, I'm kind of saying mid 2023 at the earliest. Like, I don't even know what that day could be. You know, it could be sooner. It could be later. But I do think that there is a big, I don't know what the betting, I was trying to see if I could find if people were betting on it to just see what the probabilities are. Have you seen those? Like people bet the odds.
Like sports betting, like betting on the NFL playoff. That's a great idea. I should
look into that. I just want to see if people are betting on if it's going to resume or not. And I'm really like 50-50. I think they could end up resuming it. I think you're originally correct. I don't think that the Biden 10,000, 20,000 is going to go through. So I think they're going to be in this situation where they have to resume payments. But I also think that like restarting payments without a plan is a giant nightmare, which what we saw all these different times. You know, we have new loan servicers. We have poor oversight at the Department of Education. No one's creating a plan. You need like an actual plan to restart. You need a media and communications plan. And no one's making these plans at the leadership levels to restart payments. And these things need to start now. Like if you're going to start, let's just say you are going to start 60 days after June 30th or whatever it's supposed to be. Like you should have a detailed plan to execute right now that should already be being communicated to borrowers. But like the fact that that's not even happening right now is you're going to do two things. You're either going to keep delaying it or you're going to put a lot of borrowers in a tough financial situation because like it's been three and a half years, potentially four years. By the time that they have to make a payment, like how many people have moved? How many people don't have updated contact information? Like all of this stuff, there's a new loan. I used to be at FedLoan. Now I'm at Mohela, like whatever it happens to be, right? Like people don't know. And I always say this, you know, we started loaning out, you know, we loan out $90 billion in new student loans a year. So there are, you know, 2 to 3 million times 4 years. So like there's like 10 million plus, you know, students that have never made a student loan payment in their entire life at this point in time, right? Like they don't even know what that concept is because they graduated in, you know, 2020, 2021, 2022, they're going to graduate in 2023 and they've literally never had to deal with this, right?
I can't remember the exact number. I think it's like 40 million. So like, how do you turn zero to 40 million, you know, borrowers all making payments and going back to normalcy? And I mean, it's definitely got to be there, because there's, you know, these, as we've seen with the transition from different servicers, they don't just flip on a switch and everything changes from one day to the next, you know,
right.
They've got to get all your income information of these 40 million people. They got to get your employment information for PSLF, right? There's a big, big review process that's going on right now. And, you know, it was like one of the pauses was going to expire last year in like May, or one of the eight different pauses that we've had. But it was like 3 days before payments were going to start, we got another right. payment extension. And it's like there has to be a much greater effort and implementation and planning for this to actually go through, and, you know, for this to kind of go through smoothly, as it hasn't gone that way thus far.
And that's it. And like, there just has to be more to it. So, you know, I don't think it's going to happen. I'm 50-50 if it's going to happen this year. So with that being said, stop paying your student loans, like stop making these extra payments on it. Like, you could be saving a ton of money. You know, there's a lot of economic uncertainty out there. And I know there's like a certainty in paying off your debt and like feeling like I'm eliminating it. But like, what if it's forgiven? And now you're going to be one of these people begging for a refund of your student loan payments, like so many people did. So, you know, we were very much about don't make extra payments. And then like the Biden thing came up and everyone's like, I need a refund of my payments, right? Because
I will say like one thing, if you have private loans, discount what we've been saying, right? If you got private loans, pay on those, right? But we're just talking about these federal loans, right? That haven't had interest, that haven't had payments, you know, for 2.5-3 years. So
yeah. So one of the other things that has been making the news, especially now, because I do feel like the administration continually kind of doles out little nuggets of hope for borrowers, is that this new student loan repayment plan that is also a proposal. I want to highlight that this does not actually exist yet. At the earliest it could exist is this fall, probably going to exist next year. But what's going on with this new, what are we calling it to? I'm calling it like new repay or modified repay or something. I don't even know.
Cause I've written about it a little bit, and you know, I do a little bit of blogging too. So I'm calling it new repay as well.
Okay.
And what it is it's an income driven plan, right? So what Robert and I are talking about is you have to make payments that are based on your income, right? And if you make $1,000 a month, it would be about 10% of that. So it'd be like $100 a month. It's kind of a quick and dirty example there. But what's happening is this also was alluded to earlier in that executive action, but there really wasn't a whole lot of formal details. Well, they started to kind of formalize it. And right now this plan is still in proposal, but we're in a 1 month comment period. So that means there might be some other little adjustments kind of around the edges, but I think some of the big things that we're going to talk about would probably stick around. And like you said, it's probably going to be implemented later this year. So what changed? Well, number one is that if you're on the repay plan, they take 10% of discretionary income when they're calculating your monthly payment for all types of loans, right? Well, now they're changing that so that if you have undergrad loans, those would be 5%. So if you only borrowed for undergrad, instead of payments being on 10% of your income, they're only 5%. That's huge. So for those of you that that purely borrowed for undergrad, definitely check out this plan, okay? If you have undergrad and you have graduate or professional degree loans, the professional and graduate loans will still be based at 10%, okay? So that means if you have both, then you've got to take a weighted average. But a lot of people that I meet with have a majority of loans from graduate school. So I'm still seeing that the percent of their monthly payment is 9.5 or 9.75, something along those lines. So that's the first thing that they're going to change. The second thing is discretionary income is what they use when they're calculating your monthly payment. So think about what you make. You make 100 grand, right? And you're single. So you get a deduction about 20%, you know, 20,000. So then they would calculate payments off about $80,000 of income for the year. Okay. So, well, and what they typically used to do is they would take 150%, what's called the poverty guideline or poverty, And so now they're going to take 225%. So effectively, there's a deduction that goes out before they calculate your payment, kind of like what they do for your taxes as well. That as your household size gets larger, so does that deduction. But effectively, the deduction that they're using when they're calculating your discretionary income and thereby your monthly student loan payments is also getting larger. It's not going to be huge. It's going to, you know, bring things down a little bit. Another big thing about the revised pay-as-you-earn plan that is going to be a game changer for those of you that are on the 20-year forgiveness, 25-year forgiveness, is there's an interest subsidy. So that means when you're in negative amortization, or effectively when you're on an income-driven plan, and I see this all the time with early career professionals, like if you're in a residency, if you're a physician, or if you're in like some type of a clerkship right after school, and you're making less than you would in 5-10 years, then let's say your payment's $1,000 a month on an income-driven plan, and you're only required to pay, let's say $500 a month, then there's that $500 a month that you don't pay, right? Or you're not able to pay based on the income-driven plan. Well, historically, Repay would forgive half of the unpaid interest, or what they call an interest subsidy, okay? Which was cool. But now what they're doing is they're bringing up that interest subsidy. Instead of waiving half of the unpaid interest, they would waive all the interest. So really what that means is if you're ever making below what you owe, and effectively not able to make significant payments on your loans, your loan balance would never grow. It would never grow above how much you borrowed. It would only go down if you get to a certain point in time that you're able to make significant chunks of payments. And that is huge for those of you that are doing the 20 to 25 year forgiveness track, because that forgiveness track, after you make 20 years of payments or 25 years of payments, you're taxed on whatever that loan balance is, whether it's 100 grand, whether it's 50,000, whether it's $500,000, right? And with PSLF, it didn't really change things because you're still getting that loan balance forgiven tax rate. So that's another huge one to keep in mind, okay? And then I'd say another thing, one of the big reasons why people were apprehensive to do the repay plan, if you're doing a forgiveness track, is the inability to exclude spousal income. If you're married. So let's say that you're making $100,000 and your spouse is making $200,000. And let's say your spouse doesn't have loans. Guess what? If you're filing jointly, they're going to be looking at the $300,000 of income to calculate your payments. So this is inflating what your payments could be. Well, typically what we would see borrowers do is file taxes separately. And what they would be able to do is calculate payments purely off of their income. So it'd be based off of $100,000 in income instead of $300,000. And that didn't exist in the repay plan. You actually had to switch from the repay plan into the pay plan or the income-based repayment program. And there's a little bit of stipulations to get in when there's this called a partial financial hardship. But effectively, if you're making more than you owe, you can't just jump into those other plans. So you had to do it really right after school if you wanted to get into that plan. Well, now the repay plan is also going to allow you to exclude spousal income. And again, let me make kind of a little statement that this is still in proposal state and this could change. This is what we know as of right now. But that was one of the huge deterrents for people to not pick repay. So, because if you're married and you have a spouse that makes money, you would do pay or you would do an IBR sometimes, okay? And the last thing I would say on that is that they're going to try to phase out the income contingent repayment plan and the pay plan. So if you're in one of those plans and you're considering the repay plan, just make sure that you want to get this stuff figured out by this summer, because potentially you couldn't get into the pay or the ICR plan, which I don't see many people in unless you're a parent borrower, but just a couple of details I've seen.
No, that's great. And I want to remind everyone, if you do have a question, feel free to drop it in the comments and we'd love to answer them. I know there's a few people joining in and out of the show, but I think you nailed it. And I think, I think part of the reason that repayment of your student loans is so challenging is because there's all these options, right? It becomes like analysis paralysis of what student loan repayment plan is best for me and my financial situation. And they each have all these nuances. So I'm kind of glad to see them kind of consolidating three student loan repayment plans into mm-hmm. one to try to make mm-hmm. it easier on borrowers. And then they're like sunsetting them, right? Like get to the new one. We're trying to make it easy. But there's still like some nuances, right? Like as of now, like you said, it doesn't include Parent Plus loans again, like leaving these parents out to dry. But you know, but then there's all these weird back doors too, like double consolidation, who knows, right? Like, so there really are a lot of nuances here, but it is a proposal. So, you know, there's a lot of talk on this of how it's going to save you money, how it's going to lower your monthly payment, you know, all these things. I want people to realize that this plan and or a version of this plan has actually been proposed 3 times already. This is the third iteration of it. And the last 2 times it got killed in committee and it never actually made its way out to like the real regulations, or it got killed in, you know, whatever, like negotiated rulemaking, I guess is what they call it. But so hopefully with the president kind of pushing this one through, we're going to see it actually come to life. Especially because they're just changing the terms of the existing repay plan to kind of help borrowers more. So that's a potentially big one, but don't expect it until this fall or 2024, I would venture, is probably the more likely guess, because there's potentially a lot of things happening this fall if payments do restart, things that. And, you know, these loan servicers, they have to process all this stuff. They have to keep up. They have to change their systems. The government, you know, like we like to rag on all these loan servicers all day. Like, yes, do they cause problems? Sometimes. But on the flip side, you know, the government pays them or doesn't pay them, doesn't give them enough people, you know, says like, you need to reprogram all your systems and you got like 10 people to do it in like, 7 days. And it might not necessarily be that functional. And then they change their mind all the time. So we saw that with payments restarting. It's like, how do you operate a business to help customers when you don't even have the answers yourself? And then they're rolling out these things without telling their loan servicer. So, you know, Biden announces that something happened, people call their loan servicers and like, oh my God, do I qualify? And the poor customer service rep making $10 an hour is like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I've been on my computer. I haven't watched the news today.
Right.
Like, I don't know. Right.
Yeah. And like, and where that has been super manifest, Robert, was, I mean, I had, if anybody tried to call Mohila or tried to call their loan servicer in at the end of September or even, you know, October before the October 31st deadline, I mean, just forget it. Everybody, I mean, I had so many questions. Andrew, I tried to call the loan servicer 3 times today and I couldn't get through. And I'm like, you know what? It's not even worth it, because they weren't staffed adequate to deal with that. Because guess what? What's been happening over you know, the last year and a half, 2 years, when nobody's been paying, nobody's been calling the servicer. So they've been laying people off, right? They're laying people off, and then they have these spikes. And whenever these payments start, it's going to be the same thing, right? It's going to be this huge spike. And there has to be, you know, I mean, I don't know what the right answer is there. If they need to get more funding and, you know, do that, maybe that would improve the PSLF program or these loan forgiveness programs and the administration thereof, because it would be great to see those get stronger.
Well, and I think people just don't even realize how it works, right? So a lot of people think that these loan servicers, you know, make money on their loans and they're like, you know, as a result. But, you know, these people are freelancers. They're contractors for the Department of Education. The Department of Education owns your loans. And guess what? They paid the, you know, Mohila and these companies a certain dollar amount per loan. And here's the breakdown. If you're in school, you get $1 a loan. If it's in a grace period, it's $1.68. Repayment, they get $2.85. So every loan, they get $34 a year, basically, to handle it. And so it's not a lot of money. And when you're asking them to do more with less, it becomes challenging because these are businesses. So what are our options as taxpayers, right? Our options as taxpayers is to pay them more, which frustrates a lot of people. Our options are to take it in-house, which also means we're just going to pay in a different way. We're going to pay the Department of Education to do this. Maybe it's better service, maybe not. I don't know. I'm not like the expert here. But like, you realize that someone has to answer that call and they're going to have to take it. Someone has to process this paperwork. Someone has to build this website. Someone has to do the work. It's not like, you know, it's all magic that we can just make it happen. Like, you do need to pay personnel and people and staffing. And yes, maybe we don't want them to profit so much, or we don't want them to do different things. That's a fair choice. But realize that, like, you know, the Department of Education and President Biden, the government, are their bosses. And so as a boss, you have a responsibility to clearly communicate what you're supposed to expect from them and to hold them accountable to those expectations. And I don't think our Department of Education is really doing either. They're throwing different things at them as fast as they possibly can, because they're trying to, like, you know, roll all these programs out. And then we're not holding them accountable to things. And we like to, you know, the Senate and Rep Congress likes to pull all of them forward and like badger them a little bit. But like, do we actually hold them accountable? I don't know. Right.
Yeah. And there's, you know, there's this side that thinks that we need to forgive everything altogether and just get rid of the whole student loan system because it's gotten so complex. And then there's another side where it's like, but what about the cost? Like, what about the cost? And how do we strike that balance? I don't know.
Well, that's it. It's so tricky. Like, we have this system that student loans are so toxic that we have to forgive them. But at the same time, they're not toxic enough that we have to stop lending them. Because like I said, we lent out $90 billion in new student loans in the 2021-2022 school year. But at the same token, we're going to forgive 10 to 20,000 a borrower, which was estimated to cost like, what, 300
to 300 billion. To 400 billion.
Well, in the pandemic, you've already lent out that much in new loans. So like, what is the end game for paying for higher education? The only way you solve this is for lowering the cost of education and hold people accountable to the outcomes of those educations, which I think we don't like to talk about accountability today. You know, personal accountability, holding people accountable, unless we're like flaming them on social media. We love to do that, but we don't actually have real accountability.
Person to person. Right.
Yeah, exactly. With that said, you see a lot of people with student loan debts. And I will say that all of the horror stories, I always like to rag on Business Insider a little bit because they have the really salacious headlines, but everyone kind of does it. But all the really salacious headlines of this person has $100,000 in student loan debt, $200,000 in student loan debt, a lot of that is driven by graduate school, actually. You know, it's very rare for someone that only went to undergraduate. It happens, but it's rare. For someone that went to only undergraduate to have over $100,000 in student loan debt, because there are loan limits. It's very hard to borrow it. And if they did borrow it, they typically went private as well. The face says it all.
Those can get scary with a lot of private scary. For undergrad.
Right. All right. Well, we have a few more minutes here. Like, what else is happening this year? I know one of the big things that's been talked about is borrower defense to repayment and for-profit colleges. Do you have any kind of insights into what's going on there?
Yeah, you know, and I think they've got like a list right now of different schools that people had gone to that currently you can fill out an application on studentaid.gov and hypothetically, they might be able to wipe away your student loan debt. But I've also been reading on some online forums that, you know, people that went to Ross University, they have a huge medical school and they also have a big veterinarian school that if you fill out an application or whatnot, they'll like hold your transcripts from you. So you can't like validate that you actually went there. Like, I know there's some really sneaky kind of weird stuff going on. Yeah. So Ross is part of the DeVry University stuff. Of course, a lot of people have heard about the ITT Tech and Kaplan, those for-profit things. And I have heard that some people have been getting some discharge, but I mean, I literally was meeting with a physician earlier this week that went to Ross and they were like, how do you feel about it? What do you think? And I mean, I honestly have no idea if this is going to go through. I mean, definitely, if you go to one of these schools, throw in an application. What the heck? Maybe they'll get rid of the $50,000 or the $100,000 that you borrowed from school. But I'm still in the camp that amidst this borrower defense, that they should make an overall plan and, you know, just kind of a regular student loan plan based on where they're at. So.
And you're right. And so this was all part of a lawsuit. So borrower defense, just so everyone's aware, is if your school lied, misled you, defrauded you, gave false information to you, and that's what you signed up for, right? Like, oh, we graduate 98% and they all get a job like in the first week after graduation, like that kind of thing. If you were lied to, those are the types of things that you can get your loans forgiven for. And there was a giant lawsuit called Sweet versus Cardona. Mm-hmm. And the judge said, yeah, all these schools are potentially part of that. And it's an appeal right now, but there are ways to do it. I also think it's important to realize that this is going to ripple out. I'm going to share this screen too. So this is one that's not talked about a ton. But if you notice in the news in the last few days, is all of these schools, Columbia, Stanford, Harvard, they're all like, I'm not going to be a part of college rankings anymore. I don't want to be a part of it. Well, you know why you don't want to be a part of it? Because the same law that applied that you misled people potentially applies for this. So there are a lot of people that went to very nice schools that if you were caught sending false information to U.S. News and World Report, it is no different than a for-profit school giving you false information to make your decision. So people that made these schools that made false statements are liable for potentially loan forgiveness. And I think we're going to see a lot of this in the coming days. And so that's why if you've seen the news, you've seen Washington Post, different places reporting that like all of these really prestigious schools are not going to participate in these ranking programs anymore. Well, it's because there might be some liability potentially if the information they provided wasn't fully accurate and borrowers made those decisions to go to those schools. So there's a lot happening there that people could get their student loans forgiven for. So again, don't think it just applies to this list of 168 schools that were quote unquote for profit. If you were lied, misled, your school did something shady, it could be a very prestigious state school, a very Ivy League school. You potentially have a case to get your student loans forgiven if that was the basis for why you went to that school. So I think you're going to see a lot more of that in the news in the coming weeks as like, I'm just watching this, like just all domino effect of all these schools saying, we don't want to be a part of it. Yeah. It's like, I wonder why, right?
Yeah, and I'd be interested, you know, I'll have to follow kind of the data to see where that is, you know, what if and when that does start happening. So
it is. So it's coming. And then we also have Fresh Start. So we talked a lot about payments restarting at some point in time. To me, the Fresh Start program is probably the best pandemic related student loan response that is available to borrowers. And so for those that don't realize what Fresh Start is if you meet these qualifying criteria, you can get your loans out of delinquency and default, and those delinquencies will be removed from your credit report. And it can really give you a fresh start on your credit, which has been a real problem for borrowers that, you know, they did all these things, they rehabilitated their loans, they got back on track, but like they still couldn't get ahead in their life because like they still struggle with their car debt or, you know, like their debt's higher and different things. And like, I feel like fixing that is a long way. Are you seeing anything with Fresh Start? And granted, this also depends on loans restarting. So
yeah, I mean, because again, it's talking about, you know, because borrowers that are in default really don't have a whole lot of options, right? You can rehabilitate them where you make 9 payments and then they are get you back into a good standing. You can consolidate them, but it's still on your credit report. Or you can just pay them off altogether. And that can be hard for people. But what I'm seeing is that this is going to be, you know, effective and will go through, you know, a year after the COVID pause, you know, expires. So we're still kind of in this period of time of hurry up and wait, right? But definitely for those of you that are in default, you know, there are resources that can help you. Right. There's resources that can help you get out of this because, you know, you can't go into bank, you know, if you become bankrupt, these student loans don't go away, right? That's a unique thing, you know, that these, I mean, I've had clients that have gone bankrupt and they still got the student loans, right? And they're like, how do I rehabilitate everything, right? And because then it's, you know, now you're trying to buy a house or you're trying to get a car and it just makes these different things so difficult. So if you're in default, just know that there are resources for you. You can utilize the Fresh Start initiative, get out of default and really start to build up your credit because that's going to be, you know, I mean, and I know we've been talking about this little piece of student loans that can be big for you, but think about it. These are going to be out of your life at some point. And then there's these other, you know, financial obligations that you have and your credit's quite important for each of those.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you said the bankruptcy piece. I think that's one of the other changes that people haven't spoken a lot about because it's a common myth that your student loans can't get discharged in bankruptcy. I want to be very
right.
I want to be very clear. They can. It's just very rare and it's difficult. So the latest change to the student loans and bankruptcy thing is the Department of Education asked the Justice Department and said, hey, if someone is asking for their loans to be discharged in bankruptcy, don't fight it. So that's really what like the rule change was. So it doesn't mean that you're going to get your loan discharged in bankruptcy. The Department of Education previously said, if anyone files for bankruptcy for their student loans, we're going to go petition it and say, please don't. And they just said, we're not going to fight the student loans and bankruptcy thing. However, you still have to qualify. And here's why getting your student loans forgiven in bankruptcy is so hard. You have to pass what's called the Brunner test, which is you have an undue hardship in paying your student loans. And when you have federal student loans, you can be on these income-driven repayment plans. So you show up to the judge and you're like, I have $100,000 in federal student loans. And the judge is like, well, what's your monthly payment? And, you know, you put your income in and everything and it's like $25 a month or whatever it happens to be. Well, the judge is going to look at that and be like, that's not an undue hardship based on all the criteria. And that's why you're not getting your student loans forgiven. It has nothing to do with the rules and the laws and different things like that. People do get their student loans discharged in bankruptcy. It's just very rare, and there has to be a lot of extenuating circumstances. So typically the reasons I have seen are private student loans are more possible to get discharged in bankruptcy because you don't have these income-driven repayment plans, all right? The other one is usually like a mix of disability. So people's income, even on an income-driven repayment plan, is not gonna be conducive because of something like a disability. Like, for example, maybe they don't have enough of a disability to get disability discharge, but they don't have enough ability for gainful employment to like actually pay back some of their loans. And so, you know, the combination of the medical debt that they probably incurred to get to that point with the student loans and everything else will allow for that to get discharged. So it does happen, but when you talk about all these income-driven repayment plan options, loan forgiveness options, things like that, because again, you're on these income-driven repayment plans for 20 or 25 years, and then your loan's forgiven anyway. So it's like, what's the point of a bankruptcy proceeding to get that loan forgiven if it's not an undue hardship? So it's nice to see the Department of Education taking a softer stance and not saying like, I'm gonna fight and prevent everyone from getting it. But I think most people need to realize that you're allowed to get these loans forgiven in bankruptcy. But the real answer as to why is because your monthly payment could be $0 a month under an income-driven repayment plan if you don't make a lot of money. So why would they get forgiven? Because they will just naturally get forgiven. If you don't ever make any money, right? You're zero a month for 20 years, theoretically, and then poof, it's gone, right?
No, yeah. And that's a good point, right? You know, I've seen it so rare that, you know, it seems like higher likelihood with private lending, because sometimes there's some predatory lenders out there too, right?
And
the variable rates, you know, because, you know, I guess historically there used to be variable interest rates with federal student loans, but they've really gone away from that. They've really started to make it a fixed interest rate, and you do have these plethora of income driven plans and forgiveness options. And there's just not quite that many with private student loans. I mean, there is forgiveness options, you know, based on your occupation or if you're working in maybe an underserved area, but there's not these big, broad, you know, 20-year forgiveness or 10-year forgiveness through public service loan forgiveness in private loan repayment world.
Absolutely. I love some of those niche programs, like the Maryland Home Buyer Program, right? Like you go buy a house in Maryland and they'll give you like $10,000 off your student loan debt, right? Like there's all these little random programs in your state. And I think it goes back, we touched on accountability a little bit, but if you have student loans, and we're kind of wrapping up here, we got a few minutes left, but if you have student loans, you owe it to yourself to do your homework. Like no one cares more about your money than you do. Like spend a little bit of time on Google, understand your options, realize that what repayment program you qualify for, is there forgiveness programs, federal and state? Does my employer offer like student loan repayment plan assistance, right? Like there's all these things that you could check into. And then if you don't know, you can look at using a financial planner like Andrew here. So Andrew, you wanna take us home, tell people where they can find you, share a little bit about what you do, and we'll wrap this up.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're interested, if you really feel like you need help on your student loans, whether it's you don't have any idea about where to start, or you've got a plan and you just want to make sure it's well oiled, we'll take you from wherever you are. And in a 1 hour consult, we can make sure that you're on the best way to being able to tackle and get these loans out of your life, whether it's through a forgiveness program or it's through refinancing. If you go to studentloanadvice.com/TCI, I have a page that is, you know, my partnership with the College Investor. So, you know, if you need, and again, we provide a 1 hour meeting with you to kind of tackle all your questions and get you a custom student loan plan And then after the call, we give you a year of email with us. So if there's changes, right? And there's been a whole lot of changes over the last year, we can answer those for you, right? But it's, we really try to set you up in a one-time meeting so that you have clarity for your going through the future. And it's not something where you have to pay me, you know, on a quarterly or a monthly basis. It's a one-time flat fee that you charge, So.
And that could be really helpful. So like, to me, like, where do people need this versus other help? So first off, studentaid.gov, a ton of free resources. We have a ton of free resources on our website. You know, you can probably do a lot yourself. Like it is a little complicated, but it's not like incredibly complicated. Like allegedly you went to college. I like to say like you applied for a job. Like you do, you have the ability to navigate this, but there are some scenarios where it is really complex and confusing. Let's just say you and your spouse have student loans, whether together or one of you. What if you have one high earner and one low earner and you have some different situations? What if you are toying with different jobs or career prospects and you don't know how to handle loan forgiveness or the best repayment plan for you? And especially like you do a lot with doctors, but like the whole healthcare field, I think, is a big one. I mean, I know some extremely high paid like nurses and CRNAs and different things too that like they could benefit. Teachers as well. Like, you know, it's the same kind of situations. Like you could have a teacher that has a low income and you could have a spouse that's a high income and you're trying to figure out how to navigate loan forgiveness and maximizing that. Like, you know, sometimes paying a little bit for some professional advice can be a huge ROI. Sometimes you can just figure it out. You know what? You're 22. You got your first job. You're on income driven repayment plan. And it's just you and your dog. Like, go for it. Like, you don't probably need some help yet, but like, right? Like at some point in time, you might have some questions. And the cool thing is, like you said, is that you only need a plan. And if, as long as you can execute the plan, you probably don't need a ton of check-ins, right? Because that plan should last you for a few years, unless your life changes. Maybe you got married and now you
get married, you know, big new job. And I know stuff changes, but yeah, I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head. It's if you're married and you both have loans, or if you took out a ton of loans, I'm talking about 200 or 300,000 for a graduate program. That is where I see, like, you know, usually the higher the debt you have, the more of an ROI sitting down with a professional like me can help you out a little bit. But right, if you're 22, you just got your finance or your accounting degree, I don't think you're going to need this. So.
Right. But it's there. It's a valuable tool. Andrew's great. Hopefully you guys learned something on the show. And thanks, guys. I look forward to talking to you guys next week.
Thanks, everyone.